Well, he was a boy that I knew literally from the first week of his birth in Virginia. And I loved him in ways that I've never loved anybody, is the bottom line truth. And he lived next door to us for a long time. I became very close to him. He was of a twin, had a twin brother named Jacob, and I loved them both. Spent a lot of time with them. And then we grew apart when his father and mother divorced. And so I saw him only occasionally through his high school years. Then after his high school year, he disappeared. I didn't know where he went or what he was doing. And it turned out that he was living on the road. And I would receive the phone call from him once in a while. I'd see him. I saw him once in his last 4 years of his life. And when he died, I'm a writer. Writers write. And it was my way of dealing with the grief. And so I just reconstructed his life as best I could by talking to his friends, people who traveled with him on the road. When I say traveled, it's not in a Trailways bus. They're riding freight trains around America, living wherever they can sleep. So, in the end, Eric, it was just a book that I could not write. I had to write it. I had to express my feelings about him, about addiction. He was an alcoholic probably from his teenage years. And I wanted people to understand that he was a sweetheart. He was not some bum on the street. So that's why I wrote it.
Was it cathartic for you?
In a way, but not really, not really. It's been 7 years now. It took me a long time to write it because I wanted it to be as good as I could make it. Took me a long time to find people that had been with him. But nah, it didn't change anything. I miss him every day. His mother, of course, lives in South Carolina, feels the pain every day. And I do too. I wanted him to be somebody. I wanted him to be my buddy when he's 30 years old, that didn't happen and was destined not to happen. But still, he was, I think, Eric, my bottom line in the why I did it, it's a good story to begin with. It's a facet of American life that most people don't know at all. One of my characters, one of his friends, said it's an underbelly of America that people don't even know exist. So I wanted to do it because it told a story about youth, about kids, who feel left out, kids who feel pain. So I think it's an important story in the sense of addiction also. He was an alcoholic, probably an alcoholic from the time he was 13 or 14, but went unrecognized by his parents and certainly by my wife and I, grandparents. We weren't living with him. And I think the one of the lessons, if there's a lesson in the book, the book is fun. First of all, the book is fun, although it's just even from the title, leave out the tragic parts. You know that there's going to be an unhappy ending in this, but it's an important book in the sense that he didn't choose to be addicted. Addicted chose him. Brains react differently to different substances, different thoughts, different feelings. And I think he was addicted early, while his brother, who lived the same life, was not. And in the end, it's a very personal story too, on my family, and how we tried to deal with him. And I think the important thing is intervention. You have to recognize a problem and you have to deal with it immediately. Don't say, well, we'll deal with that later. He'll be okay. It's just a phase. Well, it's not just a phase. Deal with it. Get to him quickly. So I think that's what this book is about. This book is a warning and an advisory to people
How
to
did
be
your
grand
grandson
about
get
it.
how did your grandson get the nickname Goblin?
He told me that he was sitting in a mall, panhandling, he and a buddy whose name was Booze Cop. They were just sitting around in the mall, which was one of the ways that they would get money, flying sign, meaning holding up a cardboard sign with a note on it. You know, like his favorite note was, "Zombies coming, need chainsaw, anything appreciated." You know, and so he was collecting money in a mall. And he said to his friend Booze Cop, "People are looking at us. People are looking at me like I'm a goblin or something." No, nobody said, "I'm sorry, Eric. People are looking at me like I'm a spooky creature or something." And Booze Cop said, "Yeah, like a goblin." Well, so he became Goblin.
Interesting. So you had said about the memoir that you wanted readers to stand and talk with Jared for a little while and maybe learn something from him. What did you learn about him in retracing his life after you had become disconnected from him and his family?
Well, I think that all of those kids, all those people, some of them are 30 years old, on the road like that, are running from something. You know, they're running from pain of some kind, you know, a psychic pain, physical pain. But what I learned about Jared on the road was that he was the same kid who used to sleep with me when he was 7, 8 years old. And I'd tell him bedtime stories. He was the same sweetheart, same fun-loving kid that he always was. I have a great friend in San Francisco. I showed him a picture of Jared on the road, and he kind of withdrew and said, "Now, if I saw him walking down the street toward me, I'd cross the street to get away from him." And I said, "Well, you'd be making a big mistake. You know, he's a sweetheart. You know, what you have to do is ignore the dirt, ignore the grease and the grime, ignore the scars real and imagined, and see under there that there's a human being. He's not invisible. Not invisible to you, not invisible to God, you know, there, but for the grace of God, go your grandson, your son, you know, maybe you." So don't treat them like they're garbage. They're people who are there seeking something. And if you can put a hand out to them, you're a better person for it.
Do you know if Jared ever went to get help, or his family tried to steer him in that direction, or did they just not see the signs?
Well, they didn't see the signs in time, for sure, because by the time that we all reached out to him, I did too, it was too late. He couldn't, the addiction made decisions for him. You know, my son had him, to quote my son, within an inch of going to a rehab place in Culpeper, Virginia. His mother tells a story about, you know, she's an amateur photographer. She was doing a book where she would take people to the beach in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and have them write a word in the sand as to what they would want washed out of their life. The tide would come in and wash away that word. She asked Jared one time, "Jared, let's go to the beach. You write one word in the beach." And the word that he wrote in the beach was booze. And that told her, told me, that he understood the problem, but he couldn't do anything about it. You know, again, my daughter-in-law was actually physically driving him to that rehab place in Virginia. And he insisted, got halfway, then insisted he couldn't do it. You know, even threatened to get out of the car while they were driving. The alcohol, the addiction was more powerful than any decision that he could make. By then he was, you know, 22, 23 years old.
If you're comfortable saying, do you know what, was it an overdose that that took his life?
At the end, he had all kinds of physical problems because of the alcohol, suffering pancreatitis at the end, had been in the hospital. In fact, the last time I talked to him was that night. He had called. He needed, you know, $25 or something for a prescription for the pancreatitis. And I sent him $100, probably used it for heroin, you know, against the pain, the terrible pain of pancreatitis that was going to kill him sooner or later. A doctor in Michigan a year before had called his mother to tell her if he doesn't stop drinking, he's going to die. And so it was inevitable. The heroin satisfied the pain for the moment, and he didn't wake up. You know, and his mother, he even called the coroner to ask that question. What was it like at the end? And the coroner said that he was in no pain. By then, he was feeling as well as he could feel. So, yes, it was not an overdose. Well, I don't know if it's an overdose or not. I suppose if you're in that condition, any amount of heroin is an overdose. But it just put him to sleep.
How different was this for you, writing and reporting on sports for much of your career, now to writing about something so deeply personal about your grandson?
Well, I thought it, well, first of all, you know, I'm a writer. You know, I've written about sports because that's what I knew. That's where I had grown up. And but in sports, it was, I didn't care who won. I wrote about people and ideas. And that's what this book was, people and ideas. It's very personal in a sense that I thought it was the only way that it would work if you just told the truth. You know, and I didn't, of course, I loved him, my grandson, so I cut him whatever slack that that implies. Leave out the tragic parts is the title. I didn't leave out very much of the tragic parts, but it was a story that I thought needed to be told, and the only way that people are going to accept it as the truth is if it's raw and if it's honest. And that's what I did from beginning to end.
I wonder what the rest of the family felt about a book being written about him, and you know, the challenges I imagine that they felt having to relive this for the story.
Well, the mother has been in contact with me. She got the book, of course, first, and she said that it pained her. You know, but again, she's living with his death every minute of every day for 7 years. My son and his ex-wife, you know, my ex-daughter-in-law, understood what I was doing. I kept them in touch with everything. There's no surprises in the book for them. They knew what I was doing. They understood why I was doing it. They had no problem with it. I think in time they will understand that the book is kind of the, for me at least, a writer, the best expression of love that I can make. You know, a preacher might do it differently. You know, a carpenter might do it differently, but I'm a writer and I gave my heart to that book and to that boy.
So you said 7 years ago, would it have been 2014 when he died?
Yes, January 13th of 2014.
Are there any projects that you have on your plate now that you are working on for the future?
I'm going to, for the last 10 years since I retired and moved back to Illinois, I'm from Atlanta, Illinois, moved back to Illinois, where my mother was living in Morton with my sister. So we moved back for family. And for the last 10 years, I've been writing about the Morton, Illinois girls high school basketball team. I've probably written more about them than any subject in my life and have enjoyed every moment of it. It helped me get through Jared's death, actually. Then my wife had a stroke 5 years ago, and I'm actually now working on a book about that. You know, and that, and when I say that, I mean about the girls basketball team and about my life with my wife. here in Illinois.
Wow, sort of combining those two into one?
Yes, because they are one. You know, I began writing about the girls' basketball team for the fun of it, and then Jared happened, then my wife happened, and the girls' basketball team became an escape from that darkness. You know, so it's the book that I'm working on now will be I hope a great combination of the light and the dark of life.
How is your wife doing now?
The stroke was 5 years ago. She's an invalid who cannot communicate. She's in a nursing home in Morton. I go there every day to help her with lunch. So that's been a long road also.